Thanks for listening to Outcast World. You lock your front door, don't you? You wouldn't go out and leave the front door open. Well, that's essentially what you're doing when you're not using a VPN. Right now, your data is being tracked, stored, and sold by loads of people. For a lot of people that are listening to this show, that is not just annoying, it can also be very risky. NordVPN fixes it. It's fast, it's reliable, it's number one for consumers, and it takes less time to set up than ordering a takeaway. Outcast World listeners can get NordVPN for under £3 a month. That is up to 75% off. Just go to outcastworld.net. The link's at the top. Turn it on. Forget about it. Make yourself safer online with the number one NordVPN for under £3 a month at outcastworld.net. This is Outcast World. It's Graham Smith here. And today we are joined by two people who've written what I'm going to call the Queer Field Guide for 2025. It's the Queer Field Guide that we didn't know that we needed. Lottie Jeffs and Stu Oakley are the authors of Do Ask, Do Tell, which is a sharp, funny and unfiltered journey through LGBTQ plus life in all its forms. They are both parents. They're queer parents. And they just wanted to learn a bit and get out of what they perceive to be, in their own words, cis white comfort zone. And I was really interested in them going on that journey. It's a journey that takes them from gay male tribalism, which is something I don't think gets talked about enough, sapphic identity to sex parties, aging, HIV stigma, and queer parenting. It's honest, it's curious, it's sometimes a bit chaotic, and it's deeply human. It's exactly our vibe on Outcast World. Let's get into it. So, Lottie and Stu, welcome to both of you, and thanks for joining us on the show this week.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you. Big fan of the podcast.
Thank you. Let me build a picture in my mind. Where are you right now? What's going on for both of you?
Physically, you mean?
Mentally. Let's do physically first, then mentally.
I am sitting in a field, actually, with the sun shining, which is very nice.
I love that.
I was desperately trying to find a place to chat to you that would work, and I found it, and it's beautiful.
So what's the view in front of you right now? Just like countryside, fields, that kind of thing. I'd like to think that most people should record an interview for Outcast, just sat there overlooking
it's very zen. There's a nice country manor house in the background, so it's all lovely.
Oh, nice.
Not mine,
nice.
I might add. I can just sit here and dream and look at it and pretend it's mine.
Lottie, what about you? Where are you? Are you overlooking some sort of countryside vista right now?
I'm far from it, Graham. I'm just in my little office in our house, frantically doing all the work I need to do before I have to go and pick up my kid at 3:20. Just sitting at home in London, but very happy to be here. Thanks so much for inviting us.
Well, this is what I hear from most of my queer friends at the moment. I feel like I'm one of my only, in my friendship group, I feel like me and my husband are one of the only couples that don't have kids at the moment. So all of my friends are kind of like, I've got to pick up the kids at 3:00. I've got to drop the kids off at like 8:30, 8:45.
It gets so crazy at this time of year as well, because there's like plays, sports days, summer fair. We did a Pride celebration at my daughter's school last week, which was amazing.
Oh, I love that.
But like, loads going on. So yeah, only another week and a bit to go.
Just embrace it though, Graham. Honestly, like,
what, having kids or not having kids?
Like, embrace not having kids at this moment in time. If you're thinking about it, like, go on as many holidays as you possibly can and just enjoy the quiet and life without them if you are thinking about it.
I'm sure you love your kids like all my friends do. But do you ever think, like, life would be more straightforward or easier if you weren't parents? Because I always think of this in my calculations around whether or not I want to become a parent. Me and Steve want to become parents in the next, we say, like, if we do it, it'd be in the next 3 years.
It's hard, but the pros definitely outweigh the cons. But it's just that thing of, if you are thinking about it, just enjoy going on some nice all-inclusive adult-only hotels, holidays before you can do it. But definitely, yeah, the pros outweigh the cons, and it's amazing to have. I love it, and I love them, and I just think I wouldn't change it for the world, to be honest. I moan about it because I think that's our prerogative as parents, but I wouldn't change it for a second.
So I am 42 now, and me and my partner, Steve, my husband, Steve, have been saying for years, would we not be parents? And now I'm 42. Oh my God, Steve's 45. I've just thought that through. Is it too late? Would we be too knackered if we, like, took the plunge? Is it just too, are we just too far on in life now, do you think?
I don't think so. I think you'd be fine. I think actually that it's really beneficial to be a slightly older parent. I think it gives you a lot more perspective. You've had time to live your life.
Yeah.
You're a bit more sure in yourself and who you are. And also with, if you were thinking about adopting, there is no upper age limit. So go for it.
I just feel like we'd be too knackered. I'm always tired now as it is. I'm like, imagine throwing children into the mix. And that's the thing that kind of holds me back.
Always tired now is just the same.
Oh, God.
You'd just be tired. You know, if you have a busy life, it's not like that different because...
Right, okay. Because you're used to being busy.
But me and Stu are always trying to get other people to have kids. So we're like, just don't let, you know, you've got to just make your own decision.
My ex-boyfriend, my very first boyfriend... said to me, and this is from like when I was a teenager, so it's a long time ago when we still speak, and he said to me, he thought that when he, like, they adopted, I think it was 10 years ago, around about 2012, kind of that kind of time, he thought everyone was going to join him, everyone's going to have kids, and they didn't, and he was a bit disappointed. He felt like he was the only parent in the group. And when you became parents as queer people, did your social lives massively change, or was it like a really easy adjustment for you?
Maybe Stu's didn't, because she didn't really go out partying that much.
Yeah, I definitely wasn't part of the community, like not part of the community, but, and it's something I've talked about a lot in the new book as well, is that I've never been someone who's gone out a lot in terms of, I mean, I'd socialise with friends and people. So for me, it didn't really change at all. But speaking to, I mean, on the flip side, Lottie is a social butterfly. And I would dare say that that has not changed since having kids. Wouldn't you say, Lottie?
A lot of my social things kind of involve other parents and my kid. And yes, there's probably less like going out and doing fun stuff at the weekends.
I was going to say, she was out raving at Soho House at the Pride party on Saturday night, hence why she's coughing her lungs up now.
Nothing's really changed for her.
So it hasn't changed things too much. I just think that like most of the people I hang around with now have got kids. And we're the childless ones. You mentioned the book there. Must be a really exciting period. It's called Do Ask, Do Tell. Do you want to tell me in your own words about it? Because it's a kind of... It's really broad, isn't it? It's a kind of all-encompassing thing, I reckon.
Yeah, it really is. And that was also quite daunting when we were approaching it as well.
Well, there's so much to cover.
There's just so much to cover. I mean, I think, you know, Lottie and I have said when we were planning the book, it's almost like every single chapter could be a whole book on its own right, because of the nuance and the depth that's involved in each and everything. So it was quite daunting to try and put that into a succinct chapter, as it were. And, you know, there were things we had to cut and we had to move from. And there were loads of other topics that we wanted to cover as well, but we just decided to try and focus it on the ones we did. But we're really proud of it, aren't we, Lottie? And I think I'm really happy with where we got to with it in the end. I think it's a really, hopefully, and some of the feedback we've had has been super positive to it, which is, you know, when you write something and put it out into the world is always really fulfilling, which has been lovely.
So where did the idea for the book like actually come from in the beginning?
I think Stu and I had just been having lots of conversations about our evolving relationship with the queer community, and I think we kind of recognize the limits of our own lived experience. Stu as a gay man, dad, me as a queer woman and a parent, and we realized that there's just so much more out there that we just didn't have any personal experience of, and we didn't even really know that much about. So the more people we met and were talking to for our first book, some families, trans men who had babies, trans women, people from all different walks of life, it just made us feel like this real hunger for finding out more. And I think particularly at this moment in time when there is so much, even infighting from within our community with TERFs and, you know, exclusionary LGB groups that are just not welcoming of trans people, we just feel like the time is now for like really, really deeply understanding the full spectrum of the queer community. Because if we listen and learn from people that we don't necessarily share the same experience with, that's how we foster understanding. That's how we create a better sense of community within ourselves. And that's how we fight the real enemies, which is systemic homophobia. And that is something outside of our community, really, that we could all be working together to fight rather than just fighting within ourselves.
So you talked there about TERFs as a great example, and a split by some people in the LGBTQ plus community where they want the LGB but no T or Q. And this is more widespread as the idea of LGB, no T and Q, than many people realise. What did you learn about that specific area when you were working on the book?
I think particularly, and there was a chapter that we wrote about transitioning, and I think it was really trying to, and one thing that I particularly learned and was trying to unpack was, I think there are elements of the LGB alliance side of things that are trying to weaponize certain things against us within our own community. And actually, if you take a step back and actually talk to people and actually take the time to realize the different nuances and the different things that are involved, it's not as black and white as people are trying to make it out to be. And I think that there's a real danger that people can fall into that trap. The key kind of example that I cover in the book is, it's like, I'm just going to say it because I said it in the book. It's like, I love dick. I do. I'm a gay man and I love dick. And I think that the LGB Alliance supporters kind of out there kind of make you believe that by including trans men in gay spaces, you're forcing people to, if they say they like dick, then you are transphobic. It's almost like they're doing a reverse, oh, you're calling me transphobic because I'm saying this. Whereas actually, if you actually have those conversations with trans people, which I did for the book and spoke to many different trans men about that exact topic, it's not black and white. And nor are people trying to paint you as transphobic for just, you know, because we all have our preferences. We all have our sexual preferences of any kind. But that doesn't automatically paint you as transphobic, because it's the intent and it's the world around it. And it's the bias, whether unconscious or not, that you have that's associated with that as well. And I think that's what we're really trying to do with the book. It's just, we just need to listen to each other more and actually try and understand each other rather than just thinking we need to sit on a fence.
Mm-hmm. What I think is quite striking is how the lived experience of trans people at the moment has been willfully ignored in the debate around them, trans and non-binary people. Like, their lived experience is absent from public debate a lot of the time, certainly in the mass media, and certainly in the government, the CAST report. Like, one of the major problems with the CAST report is that it consulted everybody but trans people themselves. Like, so what you're saying is, just go and have a conversation, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's wild, isn't it? Like, how wild
Absolutely,
is that?
Yeah.
That even is allowed to happen. It's just like, just listen to people and just hear them and just try. We all just need to do better to just understand each other. And like I say, that's what we wanted to achieve. And not just for trans people, but across the board. You know, I think we all, you know, we came to this book very much with our hands up saying, we have preconceived ideas about certain things and we need to challenge those. And we need to, you know, another topic was, you know, polyamory. Like, I did not understand what polyamory was and how that fit within the queer space. And in my head, I had maybe very preconceived of ideas of what that was. And again, I think that was broken down for us, wasn't it, Lottie? There were very different areas that I think we all just feel like we know, but actually, do we?
Yeah, totally. And I think there were also to challenge yourself on the kind of unconscious biases that you might harbor and not even really realize. Like sometimes I would catch myself, like, you know, things just come out sometimes that, you know, you wonder where you got these ideas from. And we have to understand that we're people in the world who were brought up in a certain culture and context, and you do carry a lot of kind of biases that have just insidiously like taken root in you over the course of your lifetime. So even things about like aging, I'd find myself, you know, making certain judgments about older people or what it means to be a 60-year-old queer person. Mm-hmm. That actually I had brilliantly challenged when we went and visited the UK's only LGBT home for older queer people. That was a really, really amazing visit and very eye-opening. But, you know, we've got to be humble enough and open-minded enough to check ourselves and to find these little, like, things that just come out of our mouths sometimes. And you think, oh, yeah, I need to think more about that. I shouldn't have said that. That was an assumption. Or, you know, I think especially as like millennials, Graham, you said you're the same age as me. So
yeah, I call myself a geriatric millennial.
We are. We're the elder millennials, aren't we? And I think as a generation, we can be quite cynical and quite eye-rolly. I think it was probably a product of the 1990s culture, where it was that sort of like Euro trash and we were all very ironic and cynical. And I think that's kind of stayed with us a bit. So personally, you know, I can find myself when I'm introduced to like a new label for a new sexuality, like arrowsexuality, lithsexuality.
I don't know what either of them are.
All of these things that I hadn't heard of before. You know, I was finding that my instinct was like to be dismissive of them.
Yeah.
Rather than to be questioning and curious. You know, I'd be a bit like, oh, another one.
Yeah.
And actually I just need to stop myself there and think, don't be like that. Be curious and open minded.
Could you explain what each of them things are? Because that you're educating me there, because I don't know what they are.
Yes, so arrosexual is another way of saying like aromantic. So,
oh right, okay, I get you.
So you might not be romantically attracted to someone, but you might have like a different sort of relationship. So you might still.
I've just googled it. Experiencing little or no romantic attraction to anyone, not having romantic feelings. Okay, yeah, I think I have heard of that. But yeah, if someone described themselves to me as aromantic, I'd be like, "What do you mean?" But I feel
and you'd be like, "What are you not going to be?"
My eyes with that.
Yeah, like I think aromantic is a funny one because just thinks like, "Oh, are you not like going to want to buy me chocolates and give me roses and take me on dates?" It sounds a bit like, you know, you're sort of against being romantic, which is like also completely not what it is. So we really go into great depths into what all of the different identities are in the book, which I think is a really useful kind of handy guide for people to have, like when they do come across an identity or a label that they've not encountered before, to just, you know, we wanted the book to answer some of those questions that you have but you maybe are afraid to ask.
It's about getting people to raise their hand, not being afraid to. It's about, and also to ask those questions. And I think that's also really important for allies, because by us as queer people raising our hands to say, I don't know. I don't know what this is. I don't understand. I think encourages outside of our community to also raise their hands and ask questions in the right way, because otherwise, because we don't know it all. Nobody does, but everybody's learning all the time. And that was really important to us as well.
So you both say your own queerness is just like one small pixel in the LGBTQ plus rainbow. What did you learn that made you rethink those assumptions?
I don't know where to start, because I feel like we both learned so much. And I still recognise that we've still got a lot of learning to go. Like I say, it's still an evolution. And that's not me just trying to pitch another book.
or is it?
I don't know. There were so many things. Like for me, another key one was religion. And I think religion and queerness is something that's super interesting and definitely is a prime example of how that could have been a whole book on its own. Yeah. And I'm not saying I want to go out there and write a whole book about queerness and religion, but it's that thing of like preconceived notions of if somebody is religious, are they immediately homophobic, was something that I would feel like it feels like we've been so attacked by religious groups potentially over the years, but actually... And have we not, and me personally, like, have I not embraced my faith because I just never even thought it would be possible to be religious? So therefore, I've just always been an atheist because of that.
Because
so
you felt excluded from the church, essentially. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where are you up to with that now, though?
I don't know. I'm still, I think it's been really interesting, and I chatted to loads of different... We chatted to loads of different people from different religions who are queer and openly queer, and actually some who are not openly queer as well. But I still, like, as an example, yesterday in front of the playground, there were some Jehovah's Witnesses outside the playground with their booklets, trying to give them out to people. And I immediately had my back up. I immediately felt like...
Annoyed,
oh. Annoyed. But then why should I feel annoyed? Because actually I haven't done the due diligence that actually does that. And I don't know. We didn't actually cover Jehovah's Witness. Like I said, we didn't have time for everything. But I was like, oh, actually, are they homophobic? Are these people that are here giving them out homophobic? As evidence with the cases that we spoke to, that isn't the case all the time. So it's just trying to, again, just open your mind and try and think about things differently rather than just coming to an immediate assumption about things.
That's so funny that you said, as soon as you've seen the people, you got annoyed. I had the same sort of, there was a knock on my door the other day and it was two old ladies. And I'm like, yes. And they go to hand me this note, this leaflet that says, you know, it's all about family values. And I didn't even read that leaflet. I was like, I don't know. I don't want it. Bye. And closed the door. Yeah. And afterwards, I thought I was a bit rude there, but because just them presenting as religious, knocking on my door with a booklet about family values, really got my back up. On that note about Jehovah's Witnesses, I've just read it's a high cost religious group. This is a study from Edgehill University in Liverpool. A high cost religious group, meaning it demands a high level of obedience from its followers, and homosexuality is condemned. So, but you do have to do your research, don't you? Because there's certain parts of the Church of England when you'd be. Church of England is one example that I'm aware of, because I'm talking to somebody who's in the Church of England later on today, where you are broadly welcome in a lot of parts of it. So I guess you just have to take everything as you find it, don't you? So you're both honest about being white, cis, well, mostly middle class. I think, in fact, we're all of us here now on this chat are all identifying that way. How did you make sure that this wasn't just another book for people who look and sound like all of us?
Well, we did really seek out people who had very different experiences to ours. Like, that was the whole point of the book. We kind of even make a joke at it at the beginning of the book, saying that, you know, we're in this bar, we look around, and all of our friends look like the same type of guy. And so it was really, really important for us to bring in different voices and speak to different people. So we did a lot of research and we really looked to speak to people who had an incredibly diverse experience and lived experience compared to our own. It was so important. The book wouldn't be the book it is today if we did that. You know, I've heard enough from my white gay male friends. Like, I don't need to know. It's no offense, I love them, but we talk, you know, I don't need to know their point of view in the same way that I need to understand what a lesbian, postmenopausal lesbian, for example, is experiencing, or a non-binary 21-year-old. You know, they're the people I really want to hear from, because I don't come into contact with them as much. Although what I will say has been brilliant about this book is that it has really diversified my friendship group. So from the relationships that we've made with doing this book, I would say that I've made new friends. I've gone out to places where I've gone to more kind of queer, in inverted commas, nights rather than just what I used to go to, which was like very gay male parties. And I've met and befriended trans people. I have met and befriended people with different sexualities or that label their sexualities in different ways. And I've realized that I absolutely love those kind of spaces, specifically nightlife spaces that just feel a bit more diverse. You know, I've discovered some really fun nights where I just feel so much more like relaxed and at ease in myself because they're not spaces that are just filled with like very, what we might say, traditionally Western idea of good looking gay man. And I've really, really enjoyed that. So a big thing for me with this book is that I've diversified my social circle,
right,
and I'm so much better for it.
Do you feel more in a space that's not so dominated by, I know exactly the kind of spaces that you mean, and the traditionally it's how people would view a gay space, particularly in London, in Vauxhall for example, athletic men, steroids, yes, everywhere, people on drugs, like and I'm not saying that in a judgy way, them spaces have become, I'm going to say, tribal and exclusionary to some people. So I can see how you'd find places that were a bit more diverse, you feel just a bit less judged, don't you? Just for being yourself.
And just, you know, a bit more fun and silly. And I think when there's not the same agenda of like sex in a nightlife space, it just instantly changes the mood. It's just a bit more inclusive because, you know, sometimes in those gay male spaces, I feel like people are annoyed that I'm like taking up space of someone that they could be like snogging.
Yeah.
So yeah, to just have kind of more fun and silly queer nights rather than like big agenda, like got to just find someone to fuck tonight clubs.
Yeah.
Is really, really good fun. And what I want to do is bring all of my cis gay male friends with me to some of these places. Like I feel really inspired to like diversify my wider friendship group and like force my, you know, Andrews and Joes and Sams, those kind of boys that I'm great friends with, into more kind of queer non-binary women. A term we discovered was flinter, F-L-I-N-T-A, when writing the book. I'd never heard that before. Do you know what that means, Graham?
I have no idea.
So flinter is femme, lesbian, intersex, non-binary, trans, asexual, I think.
Okay, right.
Yeah, so kind of like sapphic.
Yes.
Focused. I really want my boyfriends to come with me to those kind of spaces, and I want them to feel othered. You know, I think it's so important to sometimes feel other in a space, especially when you're used to just feeling like you're like everyone else the whole time.
Yeah, or you're the celebrated sort of kind of person aesthetically, which I guess a lot of people feel like that when they're in the normal spaces.
Exactly.
Stu, you never felt particularly connected, I was reading, with parts of cis gay male culture in the traditional state that we've known it for maybe the last 20, 25, 30 years. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true. And I think it goes to what you were just saying just now, Graham, in the sense of, I think you, if you're not part of that, you can feel a bit ostracized from it. And I think my own body issues and my own anxiety around my weight and my appearance definitely meant that I didn't want to be in those spaces.
Yeah.
And if I did go to those spaces, I would feel very uncomfortable. And it just always put me off that from a very early age. And then it's been really challenging, and Lottie tried to bring me in, and part of the challenge of the book was she was going to bring me on a night out, and I had so much anxiety about it, so much that I actually decided in the end, actually, I just don't want to go. And I think there was an empowerment for me on that as well, to be like, you know what, it's actually okay not to be part of that world as well, because it's what your interests are as well. And and for me, there was definitely, up until this point, it was definitely a learning point for me with the book as well, as of there, you can feel like you're not part, like I've often felt that I'm not a very good gay. I'm not very gay in that way, because I don't like I've never been, and I still have never been in the Royal Vauxhall Tavern ever.
That's actually, in terms of body aesthetics, the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, out of all of the places, is probably the one of the most, it's very male, very cis male, true. But it's not super young and super drugs. Just because it's in Vauxhall, people get that idea. But I get the idea of what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, and that's just one place. There's just many places that I've never been. And you know what? I felt like I wasn't part of the community because I didn't go to those places. But actually, I can find my community in other ways. Yeah. And I can find, you know, there are more than just that. And maybe in time I will, as I get to grips with my own body images and my own body image and anxiety, maybe I will start venturing into these spaces a bit more. But it's definitely something that I've struggled with over the years, for sure.
So traditional gay male culture and demands on aesthetics, I would argue that is destroying us all mentally as cis gay men largely. And another thing I would add to that is a kind of, and this isn't for all of the community, but we're represented in popular culture a lot of the time with a kind of mean girls culture, where we have to kind of like, even if it's kind of jokes, go straight in there and be rude to people. And that's kind of that is the kind of interaction that I'm seeing continuing between gay men. And as I get older personally, I view that now as kind of not funny, just actually fucking rude. Like, I don't communicate with everybody, like, in that way. And I feel like that lies on top of the aesthetic demands for gay men. And I think that actually the rest of us, we feel like, because we're not necessarily in them spaces all the time, we don't go out all the time, we feel like we're in a minority. But I feel like we're probably in the majority group, really, by just kind of living our lives and feeling vulnerable sometimes in them kind of environments.
Yeah. I think it goes to what Lottie was saying before, though. I think it's so societal of what we've had to face. And I think a lot of that, and again, by speaking to different people, it's something we've both come to understand, is that actually, and it's not to say it's right, and you're completely right, it needs to change, and hopefully it will change. But I think there's a lot of survival mode within that. And I think, and it was something that was really interesting that Lottie kind of unpicked a little bit, and then I kind of further unpicked it in a chapter on HIV and AIDS, was how the HIV pandemic just created this vision of sick, ill, skinny, withering away men, and actually the male physique, it was a sign of healthiness and strength. And then to your point with the kikiing and the bitching, and it was again a way of survival. It was a way of rising above the what everyone would say. But unfortunately, I think we have, not we as a community, but I think cis straight white gay men are now a lot more privileged than they were before. Mm-hmm. And that privilege maybe needs to be recognized, and just that focus now needs to switch to supporting other members of our community.
Such a good point. And I'd forgotten the reasons behind why a lot of people I knew were kind of like getting on the steroids, wanting to aesthetically appear good, because we'd had nothing fed to us as kids other than gay men dying of AIDS, highly effeminate, and it's kind of, there's been a pushback against that. Well, I'm not like that, and so I get that. I'll come to some more points around HIV in a second. You delve into dark rooms. I think, Lottie, did you have much experience in the kind of, obviously you must have heard of dark rooms, but what did you personally learn whilst you were tackling this
that
subject?
Was a great one. I had actually been in a dark room.
You had?
I'd passed as a boy once and had a bit of a fumble in a dark room, and Dusseldorf, of all places, which was fun when I was younger.
They're more widespread on the continent, aren't they? Than
yes. Yeah. I think there's, yeah. So I kind of knew the vibe. But I went and had this amazing encounter at Sweatbox in Soho with the guys that run that
The sauna, for those who don't know.
Yeah. It's a sauna, yeah. And they took me down into the basement of their club sauna. Mm-hmm. And it was just probably the strangest place I've ever done it. Certainly the strangest place I've ever done an interview. But they were absolutely brilliant and so open to talking to me. But
did you talk to the owners in the basement, or did you talk to
I spoke to the owners. Right. They were just not what I expected. I thought they were going to be like muscly, like gym bros. But they were these kind of like very interesting couple. One was like an ex-ad executive, used to work on I think The Girly Show and some other sort of like 90s legend right. TV shows, and his partner identified as a vampire. He was like, they were very avant-garde,
right?
Like,
I would have thought that. I didn't know a couple owned it. I've never considered
they
who
were
owned
very
it,
alike interesting and right. I don't want to say strange because that sounds derogatory, but
quirky doesn't sound derogatory.
Quite
though,
quirky. They yeah. were quirky. The office was very kind of occult themed, like a bit sort of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, right. kind of campy occult. So you can imagine me like sitting in this like strange basement with these two men, one that's telling me he's like a vampire merman and this other guy telling me about his career in the 1990s. TV shows and like all of these, this weird paraphernalia around me. Meanwhile, above us is like basically a sex club and a sauna. So that was very interesting, but I had like a lot of respect for what they do and how they run the club and how they're, you know, making changes for it to be like trans inclusive. Mm-hmm. And we had a very interesting conversation about how, about the code of silence in sort of saunas, dark rooms, and how that's changing with Gen Z. So they were telling me that, you know, older generations of gay men, there it was just a real unspoken, like, look. So much was unsaid between two mm-hmm. people because it was, you know, historically illegal, let's say, for men to just hook up. So gay men had sort of learned a kind of code and a way of interacting.
Cruising, essentially.
Yeah, get sex. But what he's saying is like Gen Z don't know how to do that because they've never had to. So there's a kind of real generational shift with the people that are coming to the saunas.
So what do they do, Gen Z, when do they just say hi?
He was saying they just chat a lot more.
Right, I've been to that place and I noticed dabbing. That the younger guys kind of do just chat and people right. my age and older are kind of like, we operate in silence.
No, you're supposed to be silent. But isn't that so interesting?
It really
to,
is, yeah.
see that in, like, happening live in a sort of situation of, like, some sort of, like, young twink just gabbing away.
And yeah, but that will annoy some people, like, no, that's the thing.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, it is interesting. We are at a shift of a new generation coming in. And, like, if I think about my daughter's generation, who's grown up with, you know, celebrating Pride in her school every year and all the kids being really excited to celebrate Pride, like, what is this new generation going to be
beautiful.
Like when they're 20? You know, there's going to be so many more allies, so much more open-mindedness. I don't think we can even conceive as elder millennials of how this generation might just approach life and love when they're in their adulthood.
That's so true.
God knows what will happen to like saunas.
Yeah.
For the Gen Alpha, will it be Gen Alpha by then?
Yeah, it will be. Yeah. That Gen Alpha are all, they're all about 12 now, aren't they? So by the time they all grow up. I mean, it's so interesting about the code of silence. There is a code of silence and I haven't observed these things, but I've never put it into it's Gen Z that are doing that. And I guess that, it's us, me, gay men like me that are the fucked up ones because we can't have a conversation. you know, there's younger people who are just being doing the healthy thing. I do hope for that generation that they get to grow up and do the things, be young people exploring themselves and having the fun whilst it's appropriate, and just, you know, grow older in a way that's more grounded and settled than we've had to. You know, our generation, for men in particular, came off the back of AIDS, Section 28, all of the stuff that we usually say. And I guess you don't realise how it's affected your development until you reach like 40s and you go, wow, we really had to hold a lot of things down mentally. I think we mentioned HIV before. I think the code of silence sometimes links in with HIV a bit. There was a lot of don't ask, don't tell that had to go on. I think it had to go on for a period in them sort of spaces. It's a subject I'm particularly acquainted with. For many, many, many years. I'm interested into what you found out and what your learnings were on HIV in 2025.
Yeah, I really wanted us to cover HIV and AIDS because I felt I just didn't know enough. And also what we didn't want to do is just, and this has been our approach with the whole book. Yes, there are things that has historically baked into our community, but we didn't want it to be a history book. So it was very much, as you say, it was looking at what HIV is in 2025. And I think for me, it was recognizing my privilege in many ways that it's just not had to be part of my life. So therefore I've not really, you know, I met my husband when I was 21. So for me, it was just, you know, I've not been having casual sex over the years, sadly. So it's just something that I hadn't really, but also on top of that, growing up in, you know, I was born in 1985, you know, and as I talk about in the book, and it was really interesting looking back, actually, pivotal moments in my life associated with HIV and AIDS. So whilst I had the privilege of it not having to affect me from a day to day point of view, it's also something that's been completely with me, and the stigma has been in my head, and the scare and the worry. And I think what's really interesting talking to people now about HIV in 2025 is about how it isn't potentially as life-changing as it used to be, and how people, and understanding, I had no idea what undetectable meant.
Did you not?
No idea. I'd heard the word, but I didn't really understand it. Same with PrEP. I was like, oh yeah, I've heard about PrEP. I don't know what it is really, but I hear about it because it didn't affect me. I wasn't needing to take it. I wasn't needing to be, you know, and again, I don't have many gay male friends. So therefore I wasn't even hearing it directly from them. So it was just about trying to, again, talking to people, understanding things, and having my first ever HIV test as well. Which is great. Yeah. So I went to, I went to Dean Street and had my first, and I was very open about why I was having it done, and had great chats with the team there.
They are incredible. That is in all of the world, what they do at 56 Dean Street and how they make it welcoming and accessible. And I think it's, they are brilliant, that team there.
They really are. And they were, you know, were very reassuring, and I learned so much from it as well. And I think, and it kind of links into what you and Lottie were just talking about just now as well. I think with the younger generation, it really is, and why programs, you know, Lottie and I are huge fans of, as many people are, of I Kissed a Boy. And I think one of the reasons why that show resonates with people so much is because it creates, you're seeing just gay men or queer people sit around and just talk about things, which is almost like the version of a teenage sleepover, which we never used to have when we were younger, because you wouldn't have those. They wouldn't exist. You wouldn't have, you know, God, I sat around many straight sleepovers many times before, but I never had a gay sleepover with people. And I think, you know, it's those chats amongst teenagers and young people that are so important, and hopefully why queer spaces can evolve to allow that type of conversation, because I think it's so healthy.
We had Jordan from the show on a few weeks ago. Jordan Burroughs from the show was on a few weeks ago, and he was telling me, like, he entered the show not knowing anything about a lot of the issues that they sat around talking about. So those conversations were super valuable for him, who was just in the show, and now he's he's an advocate of a lot of that stuff.
Exactly. And I think it's being able to have those conversations and understand. And I think that Adam's story on the latest series, talking about his HIV and talking on the show about being undetectable, I think would have been really powerful for a lot of people. And hopefully also for a lot of allies that are watching as because, and again, with our book, that's why we really hope it resonates with allies as well, because I think a lot of straight people potentially have the same preconceived ideas of HIV and AIDS that me as a gay man potentially had as well. And I hope that they read it and it breaks it down for them and people get to learn more about the nuances and the differences.
For a lot of people, their take on HIV is set in the 1980s. It's set with the Tomb, exactly. The Tomb adverts, isn't it? And things have moved on an awful lot. But it's societally, generally, that's how a lot of people view it. To bring in something I read just before we started to record today, you're familiar with Owen Jones, the journalist?
Yes.
So yeah. Owen's commented a lot on Gaza, and he's gone on the Piers Morgan show over the last few days. And he was a bit shaky. I think he dropped a coffee. He also has come out and said he's got ADHD. It makes him a bit jittery like that. And Lawrence Fox, so I open X, and Lawrence Fox, I don't follow him, but it comes into my feed as all of that sort of stuff does, wrote about it on there. And then the comments largely underneath it is like, he looks gaunt, must have AIDS, gaunt, AIDS, dead soon. And I was like, what? Wow. Like, the preconceptions about HIV in the general population that don't really have to think about it very often are startlingly, they're wildly out of whack with the reality of it in 2025. So I always welcome people and kind of like learning about that.
And isn't it wild that in 2025 there are actually now more heterosexual people that have AIDS than gay people?
Yeah,
it's still perceived as a completely gay disease.
Completely. It was a weapon to beat us up with for a long time, wasn't it? It was kind of, totally. They deserve it and they'll all be dead. And thank God those days are behind us. And when we think about it, that's the context of the world we all grew up in. So, I mean, even if we don't think we're messed up by that, it's hard for us not to be a little bit. I'm going to ask you both, what is the one thing you wish every straight person understood? I think each of you individually could take that. Lottie, do you want to go first?
Ooh, God, that's such a great question. I feel like I need a second with it.
Take a second.
I would say the one thing is that it's okay not to know. And I think for straight people to go, it's okay to ask the question and it's okay to just listen and understand before opening your mouth or speaking, and to have compassion, because we're all human beings and it doesn't matter who you are. Everyone is a human being. We've got to understand each other better and listen to each other, I think would be my thing.
Lottie, are you ready?
Yes, I think I would like straight people to understand that it's okay to change. I think that there's a sense that we have to make our minds up about our sexuality and our identity when we're really young, and we do, and we often feel like the way we feel when we're 18 is the way we're going to feel forever, and for some people it is. But I would like straight people to understand more about queerness generally, and how within queerness there is this space for evolution and for fluidity and for phases, and to feel one thing at one point in our life and then to feel another at another point in our life, and not to feel like that is somehow letting yourself down or changing lanes or being fickle or somehow doing it a service to your previous self, but to just really appreciate that the wonderful thing about queerness is that we can explore our identities, our sexualities, ourselves, our ideas of ourselves, and that there's not, you know, to not need to like police identities. So for example, we're seeing it now with like Billie Eilish, for instance. I was excited as the next lesbian that she was a lesbian, and she is a lesbian, or she she talks about liking girls, but there's been this huge backlash from the lesbian community that she seems to have a boyfriend at the moment. We need to be so much more open-minded. One, she could be bisexual, she could be pansexual, she's queer. Maybe she has evolved or changed. Like, we don't need to hold people to these kind of standards that mm-hmm. they have to stick to what they've said maybe in the past about themselves. Like, there's a joy in being open-minded and changing and evolving throughout our lives.
I love that. I think particularly a message for like parents who might be listening is, don't tell your potentially queer teenager that is in the process of coming out, or looks like they might be, that they need to pick a binary in terms of sexuality right this second.
Exactly.
You've got to pick one, and that's very common with parents, isn't it? You can't be bisexual. You've got to pick one or the other, and it's like, well hang on, you're really creating an issue. I think if I was to come out in the traditional sense as I did when I was 15 today, would I pick the identity of gay man? I don't know, it'd probably be closer to bisexual.
I think that's really, really interesting and like a good thing for anyone listening to this to think about. Yeah, like, what would you... I agree, Greg. I would have said the same. Like, mm-hmm. I think if I was coming out now, I would have said I'm queer, or, you know, I would have baked into my sexuality like a bit more possibility for change.
A bit fluidity.
What? Right, yeah. So, I think it's really important.
Both of you, great chat. Thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. Do you want to tell people where they can get a copy of Do Ask, Do Tell?
Yeah, you can get Do Ask, Do Tell at, I'm going to do the really, at any good bookstore. You can obviously get it. They do great deals on Amazon and Waterstones and all that, but we would always encourage people to go via queer bookshops because
Gays
the Word sell it, Queer Lit sells it, or even bookshop online. Yeah, bookshop online, which supports independent booksellers as well. So it's in a multitude of places, but I would say go and buy it via a queer independent outlet if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there for me is, if we could just move forward and make the queer community socialise more around, I'm not saying books are for everyone, but bookshops, coffee shops, we don't always have to be funneled into 3-for-1 on vodka martinis, do we? You know, I feel like that's a great way to support the queer community in 2025, is to get behind them kind of organisations and grassroots organisations at a community level. Both of you, thanks so much, and hopefully we can chat again at some point.
Yes, thanks so much for having us.
Stay with me. This is incredibly simple. If you've ever used Grindr, Googled something rather personal, or posted anything political, your data is already being tracked and sold. Think about that. A VPN can make you a lot safer. NordVPN takes about 2 minutes to set up, one click to turn on, and it just runs in the background. There's no effort after that. It's consistently voted number one across a load of metrics for consumers. It's fast, it's secure, and there's no drop-offs. Outcast World listeners can get up to 75% off NordVPN right now, which brings it down to under £3 a month. Go to outcastworld.net. Top of the page, tap the link, then you're done. Outcastworld.net for up to 75% off NordVPN.